Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did it take for scientists to prove that fully modern humans evolved in Africa? And what did it take for the rest of the world to accept that people of all races and geographic regions share African ancestry? While Charles Darwin speculated in the 19th century that humankind must have originated in Africa, it took a full century of painstaking and fiercely competitive work before most experts agreed that modern humans evolved in Africa before their descendants migrated all over the world. Martin Meredith is a journalist, biographer, and historian. His new book is called Born in Africa, The Quest for the Origins of Human Life. Martin, welcome back to THINK.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
So Darwin's ideas about human origins were essentially just a very good guess. Can you talk about what played into his assumptions?
Well, he speculated that humans might have originated in Africa. It was just a theory, but it was based on the notion that, according to Darwin, humans' nearest relatives were chimpanzees and gorillas. And he assumed that they had a common ancestor. And chimpanzees and gorillas were our nearest living relatives, it was more, and lived in Africa, it was more than likely that the origin of humans was to be found in Africa. But he had no evidence to back it up. It was a theory, but much of Darwin's work turned out to be prescient. And that was his guess about the origins of human life originating in Africa, what turned out to be entirely true. But as you say, it took a long time for it to be proved.
So Darwin's speculations were essentially ignored by the rest of the scientific community until the early part of the 20th century. What other theories about human origins prevailed at that time?
Well, there was always a distinction made between human ancestors, that is, those going back into ancient times, and modern ancestors, or modern humans. One theory is that it was much more likely that Asia was the source of the human line rather than Africa. There were other sort of theories which abounded for a long while. The first serious discoveries of human ancestors were in fact found in Asia, and a huge amount of investigation and research was put into trying to establish this. And it certainly overshadowed Africa for many decades, and it took a huge amount of effort by field scientists to suggest that in fact it wasn't Asia, but it was Africa that was the source of human life.
And the speculation about Asia wasn't necessarily completely ridiculous. I mean, as you mentioned, there were certain specimens found, and it made sense at the time.
Oh, certainly, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the scientists were groping a great deal. There were an awful lot of theories, and scientists believed passionately in their own theories, and rival schools of thought and thinking developed, and there were huge kind of clashes. But the evidence was pretty meager for many, many years. But there was some evidence, and indeed there were discoveries made in China and Indonesia, which, because they came in advance of other serious discoveries that were made in Africa, led scientists to believe that Asia was a more likely source. But everybody basically was guessing, and it wasn't until the 1950s and the 1960s that a slightly clearer picture of the origins of humans began to form.
You did have in 1913 Hans Reck making this remarkable find at Olduvai Gorge in what is now Tanzania. Can you talk about what was so important about the skeleton that he unearthed?
Well, at that particular time, it was thought that the origins of humans might have gone back as far as 100,000 years. In other words, quite recently, compared to the 7 million years that we now know that the human line originated from. And Hans Reck was sent out to... he was a German geologist who was sent out to explore part of the Rift Valley to try to confirm whether, in fact, the a site which had been named as Olduvai did actually contain ancient bones, animal bones, as it happened. That was what he was sent to look for. And he spent 3 months there investigating Olduvai and discovered that it offered an extraordinary glimpse into the distant past because it was an ancient lake bed which had been uncovered by geological formation. But when he was about to leave, one of his workmen drew his attention to a skeleton which was found in one of the one of the older beds, as they were called, one of the older formations in the gorge. And he became tremendously excited by this, because if the body had been had died, as it were, at the same time as the geological formation, it meant that he had found the oldest known human being that had ever been found. And this was in 1913. But nobody believed him, and the First World War intervened. And it wasn't for another 20 years or so that other scientists returned to Olduvai to explore it. The point about Olduvai is that because of the extraordinary sight that it offers scientists, it turned out to be one of the most prolific areas of investigation, and indeed helped establish Africa from a scientific point of view as the main base of human development.
Martin, how accurately were scientists able to date these finds before technologies like radiocarbon dating and the things that have followed it?
Well, again, it was guesswork. Nobody had any clear idea of the age, other than by associating bones that they found with some of the flora and other fauna that were in the same area. But it was a very haphazard and inaccurate method of dating. And it wasn't really until the late 1950s that that American scientists developed radiocarbon methods of dating. The key discovery was made by a Kenyan archaeologist called Lewis Leakey, who had been working at Olduvai for many years. Olduvai is in now in what's called Tanzania, northern Tanzania. And Leakey found a skull which he believed to be as old as 500,000 years old. And this was considered to be an extraordinary phenomenon. But it wasn't until a few years later that American scientists, a man called Garnis Curtis, who developed a particular radiocarbon dating technique, and he discovered that Leakey's skull, which he thought was 500,000 years old, was in fact 1.7 million years old. So it was nearly three times the age of what Lewis Leakey had imagined it to be. And this completely stunned the world. But it wasn't really until the 1960s that the basic technology for dating turned out to be particularly helpful. Now it's possible to date things far more accurately in far more difficult conditions.
So Lewis Leakey, along with his very talented wife, Mary, we should make sure we include her, they really moved the science forward. They made a lot of important finds. They were always pressed for money. How did that reality affect their progress?
Oh, hugely. But it affected all the scientists in that early period. And until the 1960s, really, it was left to a few individual field scientists to scrape together what money they could. And then the Leakeys persevered for decades with very little money. It wasn't until the late 1940s that they managed to find an American benefactor who gave them sufficient funds for them to continue working at Olduvai for a period of 7 years. And it wasn't until the end of that 7 years that they managed to turn up this extraordinary skull, which was 1.7 million years old. And as a result of that discovery, it transformed the whole scene of paleoanthropology. National Geographic became a huge benefactor to the Leakeys and to other scientists. And the discovery that Leakey made and the lectures that he gave about it in American universities and indeed around the world galvanized a new generation. And there were funds available principally from wealthy American foundations, which enabled the science of paleoanthropology and the field discoveries to advance in leaps and bounds.
Your choice of phrase there, next generation, is perhaps not accidental. In fact, their own son would later try to discredit them and take funding that they wanted to use for their own work.
Well, yes, that's true. Their own son, Richard Leakey, was a hugely ambitious and quite a ruthless individual, and very talented too. It wasn't that he tried to discredit his father. It was that he, as you say, took at a meeting at National Geographic, who were the Leakey's benefactors, argued against his father in favor of Richard Leakey's own particular project. And he succeeded in persuading National Geographic to divert funds, which his father had wanted, towards his own project. And his own father had no inkling that his son was about to almost double-cross him at a meeting in Washington with National Geographic. It gave some hint of the kind of fairly ruthless techniques that a number of field scientists have used, and all kinds of great rivalries developed. But I must say it was pretty extraordinary for the son of a very famous father to undercut him in the way that happened.
Let's jump back in time just a couple of decades, not in geologic time here. Around the time that Hans Reck was making his find at Olduvai Gorge, there was this what appeared to be a watershed discovery at Piltdown in England, and that turned out to be a fraud.
It did. The extraordinary thing is it was a fraud that convinced the British scientific establishment of its validity, and it was a fraud that lasted for decades. What happened was that there was a sort of a gap, a hiatus in scientific evidence about the origins of early humans. And it had thought that the Neanderthals were the most likely precursor of modern humans. But it was then there was a discovery made of a very arthritic old man, which turned the tide against the Neanderthals. And so there was the scientists believed that Neanderthals couldn't possibly belong to the human line. They were regarded as being an unfortunate offshoot. And so the gap emerged. And because the gap was there, what began probably as a practical joke became an enormous hoax, and the hoax was various kind of bits of bone and skull were deposited in a site in southern England.
Let me have you stop right there. We're going to take a quick break. My guest this hour is journalist, historian, and biographer Martin Meredith. His new book is called Born in Africa, The Quest for the Origins of Human Life. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist, biographer, and historian Martin Meredith. His newest book is called Born in Africa, The Quest for the Origins of Human Life. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can join us by phone by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So you were telling us, Martin, about Piltdown Man, which is this... I guess it was cobbled together from different creatures. This thing that they found appeared to have a very large brain, but the jaw of an ape. Is that right?
That's right, yes. And the theory was at the time was that humans must have had, must have been a sort of a mixture. There was what was called the missing link. People were looking for, scientists were looking for what link, the link that existed, well, they believe it existed between the ape population and the human population. And it was generally called the missing link. And the missing link was believed to have had a large brain, which was a large brain was regarded as being an essential part of the human line, but also ape-like features. It had an ape-like jaw. And in fact, the jaw consisted of an Asian orangutan, and the skull came from a 17th century human. So it was a complete hoax, but it was a sustained hoax, and the hoaxer kept on laying new clues over the years. And so the scientists who believed that in the hoax and the, that this was an indeed a human ancestor, the scientists who believed that were all the more convinced because of the new clues that were laid in the ground, which they then went on to find.
What would be the motivation for pulling off something like that?
Well, it was possibly started as a practical joke by... there are two individuals who believed to be responsible or have been fingered to be responsible. One of them was turned out, as it were, in later decades, after a lot of investigation, to be an inveterate hoaxer. He was an amateur archaeologist and wanted to make his name. But the other individual was a serious scientist, but who was engaged, first of all, in a feud with other members of his museum establishment, but was also known to be a huge practical joker. And it was possibly that he wanted to discredit some of his rivals, or that indeed it was a practical joke which got out of hand. But the hoax was perpetrated in about 1910, 1911, and it wasn't until the 1950s, 40 years later, that the British scientific establishment woke up and proved that, in fact, it was nothing more than a hoax. But it had distorted the science of paleoanthropology, particularly from the British perspective, for up to 40 years before then.
Yeah, what a waste of time.
Well, a waste of time and a waste of talent, but it's the way that as this particular science developed, because there were so many gaps, because everything depended on theories and speculation, it was open, if you like, to all kinds of absurd theories which might have survived for 5 or 10 years and then were completely discredited. But also it was open to the abuse of people who wanted to plant evidence, as the Piltdown hoax was.
And there was also the idea among, I guess the only way you could describe them is white supremacists, that humans must have fully evolved somewhere in Europe and then drifted back down, as opposed to the other way around.
Yes. The whole focus of attention was on Europe, and it was because... in a way, the first proper excavations were uncovered in Europe. The first evidence of a being other than Homo sapiens, in other words, modern humans, the first evidence was uncovered in Europe in the mid-19th century. And that was the first Neanderthal which was discovered. The Neanderthals turned out, in the end, to be cousins of modern humans. They are a sort of a branch of the human line, which didn't survive. But because the discoveries were found in Europe of the Neanderthals, and because subsequently another group was found in Europe called the Cro-Magnons, which were in fact modern humans. But because they'd been found in Europe, it was assumed that Europe had led the way in the advance of the human race. And it wasn't really until the 1980s, with the advance of genetic science, that a completely different picture began to emerge.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Stephen in Dallas. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
My name is Stephen. I'm originally from England. I live in Dallas, Texas. In 1997, I opened up the New York Times, and there was a discovery from Cheddar Man, and it was my cousin, and it was identified by DNA. When I phoned up Southern Methodist University subsequently, they were very skeptical about that discovery, even though it was from Dr. Brian Sykes at Oxford University. I thought perhaps you might like to comment.
Do you want to talk a bit about Cheddar Man, Martin?
Yes. I mean, in general, there have always been a huge amount of skepticism about the advances of that scientists have made, in particular in the field of genetics. There are those of a religious persuasion who won't accept that genetic science can actually produce real substantial evidence about the origins of humans. It is really that old age-old contest that goes on between religious belief and scientific evidence. The DNA now is so far advanced that it's possible to make extremely accurate and indeed extraordinary discoveries about the origins of all kinds of humans, old bones, and it is the DNA evidence now which is used very substantially to discover more and more about not only the origins of humans, but their movements around the world. It is genetic evidence which has more or less proved that the origin of all humans comes from Africa, and that all humans outside Africa originate from an exodus which took place about 60,000 years ago. Now, you will get many people to dispute that, but the evidence that the scientists produce is pretty solid.
And that exodus is very likely to have been catalyzed by climate change.
Yes. I mean, climate change has been a huge factor throughout the whole history of human development, going back 7 million years ago. There have been more than 20 species of human ancestors which have been identified. All of them have become extinct, other than the one that we all belong to, Homo sapiens. One of the reasons for the extinctions and the changes and the evolution that has taken place is climate change. And the climate has changed hugely over at particular periods, very, very marked changes. So there were huge changes which occurred, for example, 6 million years ago. There were huge drops in temperature 2.5 million years ago, which occurred at roughly the same time as the Homo line began to emerge out of the Australopithecine line, which is and the Australopithecines were human precursors. And the same periods of climate change have had a huge and dramatic effect, going again at about 1 million years ago, 800,000 years ago, and of course all the way through the ice ages. And there is evidence to suggest that about 80,000 years ago or 70,000 years ago, the climate change was so severe in Africa that the modern humans almost became extinct. Hmm. There is some evidence to suggest that there were as few as 5,000 humans left in existence at that particular time. So climate change has had a dramatic and lasting effect on human development.
It's really, sort of chilling to think about how close we came to not being here.
Indeed. I mean, there are all kinds of narrow escapes, if you like, that the human line has had. It's been one of the... It is because the existence of humans has at times been so precarious that it has spurred humans on to innovate. And one of the periods of innovation, or several periods of innovation, have come at roughly the same time that human existence has been under threat, mainly kind of from climate change and therefore changes in food availability and just cold and various other kind of factors like that. But the periods of innovation has been built into human development because of the ways in which human existence has come under pressure. And so innovation is still very much part of the human psyche.
We have an email here from Marty in Dallas who writes, what are the implications of the recent discovery of Neanderthal DNA in some but not all modern human populations?
Well, this is a very modern finding, and for many years the top genetic scientists were convinced, this is until 2 or 3 years ago, the top scientific geneticists were convinced that there had been no interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals. As I said, they are cousins. That is that modern humans or the modern human line and Neanderthals have a common ancestor which lived about 800,000 years ago. And the Neanderthals went off as a branch, as it were, in Europe and became extinct. Although their origin was Africa, they were part of a migration which occurred 800,000 years ago into Europe. Hello?
Go right ahead.
Hello?
Can you hear us? Okay, we may be having some problems. Martin, can you hear us? All right, we're going to reconnect with Martin Meredith, our guest. He is a journalist, biographer, and historian, and author of the new book, Born in Africa, The Quest for the Origins of Human Life. We will continue to take your calls, so please hang on the line. We will also take your emails once we get Martin back on the phone. If you would like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Martin, can you hear us now?
Yes, sorry, I can hear you now.
Oh, good. You were talking about the Neanderthals and the recent discovery that, in fact, some humans might share some genes with this branch of humanity that was thought to only be a cousin of Homo sapiens.
Yes. The real question was whether they had, in fact, interbred. Mm-hmm. And modern DNA shows that, in fact, a very small proportion of DNA, and this applies particularly to populations in the Pacific, the evidence is there that there was a small amount of interbreeding that went on between modern humans and Neanderthals. They overlapped in existence for a period of 10 or 20,000 or maybe 30,000 years, and it was thought that they were so different that there wouldn't have been any successful interbreeding. But the astonishing discovery was made two or three years ago that, in fact, there had been interbreeding, and therefore there are various small groups of modern people who have Neanderthal genes in them.
I got a chuckle out of the headline that came out not long after that time that Ozzy Osbourne was among the people who shared Neanderthal genes.
Yes. Well, the none of the populations in Africa have any Neanderthal genes. Hmm. It is only those Africans that left Africa in the Exodus 60,000 years ago, and who came across remaining bands of Neanderthals, and clearly there was a certain amount of mixing that went on.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak next with Brian in Arlington. Hi, Brian. Oh, you know what? We have just lost Martin Meredith once again. We will get him back on the line right now. We will take a quick break here in just a minute, but remind you that if you would like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here with journalist, biographer, and historian Martin Meredith, whose new book is called Born in Africa, The Quest for the Origins of Human Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Martin, glad we have our phone issues resolved. Thank you so much for being patient with us.
No, it's fine.
All right, let's go to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Brian in Arlington. Hi, Brian.
Hi. My question was, you did discuss Leakey at some length. What do you think of the contributions of Raymond Dart and Phil Tobias in regard to Mrs. Pleas?
Well, Raymond Dart is kind of one of the great substantial figures of a slightly earlier generation than Leakey. Indeed, Phil Tobias, again, there's a third person called Robert Broom, who was also hugely important in making the early discoveries, along with Raymond Dart, Raymond Dart and Robert Broom basically laid out the foundations of what became accepted eventually by the scientific establishment about the importance of the Australopithecines. Indeed, it was Raymond Dart who coined the phrase Australopithecines. Australopithecines are the forerunners, really, of the human line. So Raymond Dart and his contemporary, Robert Broom, and indeed the next generation, Tobias, were all kind of hugely important. In the early stages of scientific endeavor, attempting to establish evidence about human origins, it was left to a handful of individuals to make advances, to make progress. And it is because there were so few people that their names kind of stand out. And the early ones were certainly Raymond Dart, a South African, or indeed an Australian living in South Africa, and Robert Broom. And then that was really kind of followed by the Leakeys, Louis Leakey, and indeed almost more important than Louis Leakey was his wife, Mary, who was a hugely important figure in her own right. And then the next generation of leakies came on. But it's very noticeable that the early years of scientific endeavor were carried out by a handful of individuals, of whom Raymond Dart, as you mentioned, was hugely important.
The one perhaps great misstep that Raymond Dart seemed to make was not following the nomenclature that the British Academy thought appropriate at the time.
Well, yes, but that was certainly true, in that he devised this name, Australopithecus, which, as indeed the rather stuffed, pompous individuals in the British scientific establishment pointed out, that it was a mixture of Latin and Greek, and that this was not appropriate. What he'd actually done was identify a human precursor, which was of enormous importance. It's one of the first proper identifications which had ever been made. But because it had a very small brain, and because the British scientific establishment was convinced at the time that the brain was the most important driving factor in human development, because Raymond Dart's Australopithecus had a small brain, the scientific establishment decided to discount all the evidence that he'd mounted to claim that it was part of the human line. And indeed, he turned out to be wrong, and the British scientific establishment he turned out to be right, and the British scientific establishment turned out to be wrong.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rick, in Garland. Hi, Rick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A few years ago, there was a big uproar. I guess they found a skeleton on the Columbia River, and it was Kennewick Man. And then the Secretary of Interior got involved, and it became a big uproar, whether this was a Caucasoid, Caucasian-type person. And I wondered if there was any more definitive answers. I haven't heard much about it since then.
I'm sure there would be a more definitive answer. Well, all the indigenous indigenous population of the Americans, again, have an African origin. That is, they were part of this exodus which left Africa 60,000 years ago. And because the genetic scientists have established what they call genetic markers, they are able to trace the movement of various peoples as they moved away from Africa into other parts of the world. And there is a very clear movement of people who moved through Asia and Central Asia and East Asia, and then eventually crossed the Bering Straits into Alaska and North America. And the original indigenous population of Africa can be identified on DNA evidence as being, if you like, African migrants. The Caucasians were, if you like, a European version of the same exodus. What occurred after the exodus from Africa 60,000 years ago is that different groups moved in different directions and met different ecologies and diversified according to the areas that they met. And hence, in Europe, they, for example, developed a lighter skin, whereas other groups will have retained, if you like, dark skin. So the idea that original inhabitants of North America were Caucasian, in a sense, is a bit misplaced. The Caucasians came later, having come from Europe, but they weren't part of the original population.
What can we learn about our ancestors' travels by studying language and the ways that it has spread over the planet?
Well, language is a hugely complicated business because, unlike bones and skeletons, there's no evidence about language.
Yeah.
And so there's no agreement really about the time at which language evolved. It obviously evolved from probably from vocalizations made, which became, if you like, developed into simple words, and then simple words became joined up to express more complex subjects. The prevailing the consensus of opinion at the moment is that it wasn't until about 100,000 years ago that a form of language developed. That is, there had been vocalization before then, but nothing that could be called, if you like, a simple language.
Mm-hmm.
Some people argue that because of the complexity of human speech, it must have developed, or the ability to speak must have developed far back as 2 million years ago. But that is not the accepted opinion at the moment. But it's an area which is still argued about. What is clear is that when African emigrants moved out of Africa 60,000 years ago, they had by that time a working language. And then, because they diversified all the way around the world, languages, different forms of language, began to spring up. All the existing languages in the world today can be, if you like, traced back to that particular time. But the evidence, again, is very, very rudimentary, and it'll be a long time before there's any real clarity about the origin of languages.
It's remarkable to think, let's just take for the sake of argument that 100,000 years figure for complex languages beginning to emerge, that we have evidence 300,000 years ago of hunter-gatherers using symbolic expressions of themselves.
Yes. The evidence really consists of certain pigments and the use of certain pigments, which suggests body painting, and body painting suggests symbolic sort of activity or an understanding of symbols. But the language that probably occurred at that time, if those that argue that there wasn't a more complex form of language that didn't occur until after 100,000 years ago. So if you go back 300,000 years ago, there was obviously some form of vocalization. That was, words were being used probably to express symbols and thinking and so on, and it may well be that from that time words were became more sophisticated, were joined up, and perhaps rudimentary sentences were formed.
Mm-hmm.
So it may well be that 300,000 years ago words were being used, but not language as such.
I think we have time to take one more call. Let's speak with Jesse in Denton. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. Calling from Denton, Texas. Shout out to the University of North Texas. Very excited to be talking today to you, Mr. Meredith. And my question is in regards to, we've been discussing about 20 different pre-human species. My question is, why is it that we had such a variety of pre-human species at one point, but now, since then, there's been no more to be produced from whatever the first producing species was?
Well, the evidence is that right from the very beginning, that is, of the human line, which goes back about perhaps as far back as 7 million years ago, but that there was, and there always have been, periods of experimentation. That is that it goes back to the old Darwinian theory of natural selection, is that generations develop according to features which benefit them. So, and this leads, if you like, this is the driving force behind evolution. But many attempts of experiments perhaps fail, and certainly many have gone down sort of evolutionary cul-de-sacs. They just haven't survived. And it's partly because the whole human line has always been under extraordinary pressure, attempting to find sufficient food, sending off hostile weather, facing climate change which makes their existence precarious. It's in those circumstances that, if you like, relatively few survivors have emerged, or to put it another way, that if you like, experimental versions of the human line have failed to survive, and it goes back perhaps to the time, well, the most extreme time of perhaps 80,000 years ago, when there were relatively few survivors, that the climate conditions were so severe that there are about only six places in Africa where humans could have survived. And that means is that, if you like, all the weaker, less developed versions of the human line facing similar sort of predicaments and dangers, they just didn't survive. And it's only, in a sense, in relatively recent times, with the development of fixed kind of communities and modern science and health treatments and so on, that there has been this extraordinary human explosion, really, in population. Previously, human existence was very precarious. I think that accounts for the fact of so many species, earlier species, having died out. Life was just too difficult for them.
What would you say are the greatest enduring mysteries of how we evolved into our current state that haven't been solved by the excavations we've made, by DNA sequencing, things that are still really vexing the scientists who are working on these questions?
Well, there are a huge number of gaps. All that we have really at the moment is an outline, and the gaps are much bigger, if you like, than the outline. We don't know, for example, very much about the beginning of the Homo line, the beginning of the human line. We don't really know the identity and the exact nature of the first human line, which came into existence about 2 million years ago. We also don't know the nature and identity of the common ancestor of both the human and the chimpanzee line. We know that they split, chimpanzees being, if you like, the closest relative to humans in evolutionary terms. We know that the split occurred about 8 million years ago, but the evidence about who that common ancestor was
remains to be discovered.
It's speculative.
Martin Meredith is a journalist, biographer, and historian. His new book is Born in Africa, The Quest for the Origins of Human Life. Martin, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.